I wasn't doing that for you to put at the front of the... That would be a great start to the podcast.
No. No one will ever hear it.
No, well, but you've still got it recorded.
Maybe.
Blackmail.
Welcome to The Writer and the Critic, a monthly podcast devoted mostly to speculative fiction books, reviews, and critical discourse.
Oh, that's better than idle gossip. I like that. Critical discourse.
Yeah. We don't really do idle gossip. Spend more time critiquing the books now.
Yeah.
So there we go.
You can introduce me because the people have forgotten me.
I'm your host, Kirsten McDermott, and sitting next to me is your other host, Ian Mond. Hello, Ian.
Hello. Hello, everyone. Before we get going, I'd like to first thank you for the cup of tea.
Oh, you're welcome.
Second month in a row, but we won't talk about Steve this time. And I would also like to thank our listeners who were who had the ability to vote for the Hugos, who nominated us very close to a Hugo. We
almost got on the ballot this year. Yeah. Which is very nice.
Nearly got a pin.
Oh, that's right. You had a pin, dude.
Yeah. And I've seen a couple of people, oh, well, you'll get on next year because Squeakcasters recuse themselves. And I said, well, what guarantee will we get on next year? Maybe our last year's effort was the greatest quality we were ever going to produce. I mean, look at these podcasts for this year. First off, we haven't even done 12 podcasts.
Because, no, you know, almost.
Jules has had babies. You've moved houses. I'm missing another month.
I'm going to the UK next month.
Correct. We're missing another month. So, you know, we haven't been a reliable podcast. And who says the quality even matches what we did in 2012?
Stop it.
What?
For goodness sake.
Do you think it does?
I don't know. That's why I don't vote for myself. Yes. I'm not a judge of my own.
And
quality.
We just want to say that clearly, that we don't vote for ourselves.
Oh, for
so.
God's
what?
Sake.
What? Well, people are. No, because you stop making me feel guilty. Because people did mention it on Twitter.
Mention what?
Oh, you only missed out by one vote. And then when I said I didn't vote for myself, there was a couple of people who went, arg, as in maybe you should have.
Oh.
And then you jumped in and said, yes, that you don't do it either.
Well, I think if the only way you can get on a ballot is by voting for yourself, you probably shouldn't be on that ballot.
Yeah. You've probably just offended a whole bunch of people we know.
No, I just mean, like, if we, you know, if it was our vote, like, if we'd nominated ourselves, we would have got on the ballot, yay, but we had to put ourselves on the ballot, not so yay.
Yeah. Look, I don't do it for the same reason. Yeah. I don't do it because I want to know that it wasn't because of anything I did that got us on the ballot. That was because people genuinely loved us. And that's why I thank people here, because they nearly got us there. Okay. And maybe you'll do it next year. Not forcing you.
Oh, stop what? It.
I'm not doing
it. Okay, we're not having another 9-month election campaign in this country.
All right, so we'll talk about the books, because I don't have anything else to rabbit
on about. No, we have dispensed with the idle gossip, which gives us more time to talk about the books and more chance of wrapping this up under 90 minutes.
Well, for some people, that's not long enough.
Well, it's long enough for me.
So what are we starting with?
We're going to start with the book that I brought to the table, which is Every Day by David Levithan, which is marketed, I find out retrospectively, as a young adult novel, which I guess is not really a surprise.
I already thought it was a young adult novel, given it's about young adults.
My head's not like that. I am occasionally surprised by when I read a book and someone says, oh, that's a young adult novel.
It's
like,
does
really?
Have the look of a literary novel.
It does.
In terms of packaging. Now, I know we're getting very prejudiced here about packaging.
No, there are tropes and coded signals about what we all know. We all know what a genre book looks like. We know what a horror book looks like.
It's very much the literary novel where the title is in lowercase and the name of the author is in lowercase. And it's got muted colours and a border around it. And it actually is a beautiful package.
It's a really nice package.
So it's marketed as YA, or it is considered YA? Because I wouldn't say that doesn't look like it's marketed.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's considered YA, but I don't know. It's been a long time since I've been in a bookshop. I don't know where it sits on the shelf. If anywhere.
Is that because where you live there are no bookshops?
there's one. There's a Collins, which apparently no one told them.
What, that the rest of the Collins have shut down across Australia?
The Collins have gone out of business. The one in Ballarat's kicking.
Well, obviously not much because you don't walk in there. Anyway, yes. So you chose Every Day by David Levithan.
I did.
Is it Levithan? Is it
Levithan?
Some say the TH.
Well, I saw a YouTube interview where he introduced himself as David Levithan. Yeah. So I think we might
know the author's dead. We all know the author's dead, so that's
sure, but I think
anything.
They still are the authority on how to pronounce her own name, if nothing else. I think still they get to say, here's how you say my name.
Are you going to tell people what this book is about?
This book is about a protagonist by the name of A, just the letter, who they've chosen that letter as their name because their situation in life is that they wake up every day in a different body, and the only correlation between the bodies and themselves is the age. So if when they were three, they woke up in a three-year-old's body. And so on. So the age maps to how long they've been alive, but nothing else does, except for the, I guess, convenient geographic aspect of it, in that they're always within a fairly enclosed geographic area, unless the body that they're in happens to take a day trip that day, in which case...
And then stays overnight in wherever that place is.
Yeah, because A will switch bodies at midnight or... thereabouts.
Yes. No, it's at midnight exactly.
I know, it's a bit Gremlins, isn't it?
Yeah.
yeah, so
he doesn't deal with that, David Levithan, really. He's a little bit blurred.
Yeah, because largely this book is somewhat of a thought experiment, so...
Yes, it's very much a thought experiment, although...
So you can have little things like that.
I would argue, though, that A does spend some time, because A has been doing this since... A was 16.
Well,
sorry, A was
A
zero.
Was born.
So has been doing it for 16 years, sorry. So A does think about it.
Yes.
Yeah, and as the book goes on, there's actually an opportunity to think about it a bit deeper, but we're never really given...
Yeah, there's an opportunity, but it's eluded rather quickly.
Yes.
So A lives their life day to day, always waking up in a different body, in a different house, with different family and friends and so on. And that's... It seems that is how A's life will continue until, if what you assume, A will die, because at some point there won't be 112-year-old bodies to jump into. So assuming A will die at some point, because
A does wonder if someone dies, does A jump to the next body?
Yeah,
or does
A
die with that person?
That's never happened. So
no, well, because A's 16.
Yeah.
Well, not that it couldn't have happened.
Well,
but yes.
Kids die.
Yes.
So that's never A's never been in a body that's died while A's been in the body.
Yeah.
So that's basically the structural mechanical setup of the book, and the story is that one day, the first day we meet A, A falls in love with a girl, really, really quickly, as I guess teenagers do.
Well, in his case, he has to. If he's going to fall in love, it's got to be bloody quick. The time is ticking. Yeah. Although there is this whole thing in
which
the book.
Which is kind of a bit of a problem with – it's a weakness with the book, isn't it?
It is. And A does think about the fact that – can I just use pronouns, please?
Well, okay, let's
get the pronoun thing sorted.
Let's get this out of the way because the book is very explicit, and A does talk about it several times to the reader and also to Rhiannon, who's the girl they fall in love with. That they don't think of themselves as a boy or a girl or a particular race or a particular sexuality or preference or anything like that.
That makes sense.
They're floating, as
correct.
It were.
They literally – there would be no reason why you'd think of A as a he or a she.
Except we do, don't we?
Yes.
Because when I was reading it, I was catching myself all the time reading A as male and feeling a bit cross with myself.
Oh, you my God, said, I also felt cross.
Yeah, and you said the same.
Yeah,
when
about
I
halfway
you.
Through the book, I'm thinking to myself, I'm not meant to – I'm reading this as male, but it's not meant to be the case. And I don't think David Levithan wants us to think of A as
no,
male.
I don't think – no, I think that's part of the point of the book. And I have to say, after I read it, I went off and hunted down some reviews and – I'm not saying I've read every review of the book that there is, but all the reviews that I did read, every single reviewer went out of their way to say, I read A as male, but it doesn't have to be male. I'm sure other readers will think A's female. In fact, there was even one review by Sarah Polsky on Strange Horizons.
By the way, Strange Horizons donations, a fund is happening at the moment. So
okay.
No.
Will it still be happening when we've got this?
I believe so. And the only reason I mention it, sorry, I didn't mean to jump in like that because you've given me this stunned look.
Yep.
Because we use Strange Horizons as a major resource on this podcast.
We do.
And that's why it should continue to exist.
Okay.
And you should
donate. I'll put a link in the show notes.
Yes, please do.
To that. And hopefully this will be live on the net before that fundraiser is over.
I believe it goes for a month or so.
Okay, cool. Yep. So this was a review by Sarah Polsky on Strange Horizons. And about halfway through the review, it's a couple pages when you print it out. At the end of a paragraph, she puts in brackets, after she's talking about the mechanics and the book, and she says lovely things about it. And then in brackets at the end of a paragraph, she puts, after meeting A as a boy in Justin's body, I certainly struggled not to think of A as a boy for the rest of the book, and I caught myself using masculine pronouns several times while writing this review. And she pointed out, and I checked afterwards because I hadn't read the flap copy, but even the flap copy makes use of he. So there's one instance of he in the flap copy. So even whoever wrote that.
It could have been David.
It could have been. Well,
is it usually the author?
Sometimes not.
Okay.
So, like, all of the reviewers are all saying, I read him as he, I'm really sorry, you don't know any blah, blah, blah. But if everyone is reading this character as a he.
So you think that's a failure?
I think that's a. If half the people read it as she and half the people read it as he, that comes from the readers and where they're taking it.
Yeah, okay.
I think the reason, because I was trying to decode why I was reading A as a he, and I thought, well, maybe it's because the author's male and it's a first person narrative, and I know that I do have an automatic response, as it were, especially in short fiction, not so much novels, but especially in short fiction, of mapping a first-person narrator to the gender of the author, just because usually the name's right there above when you start reading it. And I know that that is something I have. But then also, I think more importantly, you do have A begin in the body of a boy. So that's when we first meet him. He's a him.
Yes.
When we first meet him, he's Justin. Yes. He's the boyfriend of the girl he yes. falls in love with. But then I think even more importantly is the girl he falls in love with is, and she's quite explicit about it, she's definitely heterosexual.
Yes.
She's not interested in girls. And when A is in a girl's body a few times and interacting with her, she's less comfortable, certainly less affectionate.
They do kiss when they're both.
And she said it was weird.
Yes.
Right. A kissed her as in a girl's body, and she said later it was weird. It made her feel weird. And not in a good weird way, just because she's not. She's heterosexual.
Yep, gotcha.
Right? She's not attracted to girls. So when A is in a girl's body, that's not what she's interested in. So because you've got that what would be from Rhiannon a heterosexual relationship, I mean, maybe A is even acting in different ways when they're in differently gendered bodies. I don't know. But it's weird, isn't it? I mean, if everyone is reading this book
but
as a
isn't
he.
Isn't that the point that Levithan's making? Isn't that the part of the thought experiment?
It is, but if
I don't think he's
but if everybody is reading A as male.
Yeah, but you see, if you get into an uncomfortable land about talking about, well, is it because there's a masculinity to the voice of the novel?
I don't think there's a masculinity to the voice of the novel. I think it's the mechanics of the novel. I think it's positioning A as a boy from the get-go, so that when you meet him, he's in a boy's body.
Section is a good 20-25 pages.
It is. Yeah. It would have been, and that's when he meets Rhiannon, and they go and have their thing, and it's very much a boy girl.
But that's the
thing.
Brilliance of the book. That's the rug that David wants to pull.
Yeah,
he wants you to. He's already told you that this is. I mean, the black back
but
blurb
maybe,
tells
maybe
you that this character is going to be jumping from body to body.
Of course.
But he wants to start off as a boy girl relationship, sitting on the beach, having the most beautiful day ever. I mean, that's what this whole thing is, the most perfect day ever. And then he wants to pull that rug. And I don't. The next body actually goes into is a boy's body as well, but still pull that rug.
Yeah, I think I don't know. It might have. Look, it would have been interesting if you'd read the book starting out in a female body, I'm just saying it would, and you can't know because it hasn't.
Can't we just accept that we're all hardwired for a male default? Can't we just accept that after 4,000 years of paternalism?
I think we are, but when you get ushered very easily into that male default by starting with a physically male character having a relationship with a male female heterosexual relationship with a girl, you are very much ushered. I mean,
he ushers us in, does it on purpose. Yeah. It's a honey trap. He's got us sorted. He's got us into a nice love story. We've hooked. He's got us in there, and then he slaps us in the face. And I love that. And because throughout the – it's not like I finished the book and I thought, oh, wait, I never thought about the gender. You're thinking about it from about – if not the first third of the way through, by the halfway point, you really are thinking, well, actually, how do I consider
that? Well, A very explicitly talks about it several times.
Yes, true. True. But it is a key element of the book.
It and is. It is.
I just, know what you're saying.
It's just interesting wrong. And I think – well, no, but I think it's it is – interesting how it seems like that it's more than just default reading as male. I think
no, I think that's
because
all it
you've
is.
Got because you've got a whole bunch of people who are trying.
So, yeah, all
not
people
to,
that are, I know,
and not.
But we're all hardwired. Yeah.
No, we're not hardwired. That's a really bad phrase.
Okay, the race memory. Call it what you will. Environment.
Yeah.
No,
I'm just not sure.
Nature,
I think
just...
I didn't feel A to B, and this was the other thing. I think. One of, and I really did like the book, and there's a lot about it that I do like.
You chose it, so you better bloody look.
But one of the problems I had with it that I kept coming back to over and over and over, because Ace has a lot of, I mean, Ace a bit too wise, really. And it, I don't think using the explanation that, well, A has lived in all these different bodies and had all these different perspectives and therefore they have a bigger view of the world. No, but they still only have lived in a teenager's body. There's lines lines that A says, like one of the ones that really jumped out at me was very early on, actually, when they're at the beach and there's a line that A says, not to Rhiannon, just as part of the narrative, so to the reader, there is a part of childhood that is childish and a part that is sacred. Suddenly we are touching the sacred part, running to the shoreline, blah, 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 blah. That's a really – I'm not sure how – I don't care how many bodies you've lived in. As a 16, 17-year-old, I don't think you have that retrospective experience of what childhood –
isn't the implication
you know?
That he's had to grow up quicker even though he hasn't actually had a proper child – I mean, he's never had a proper childhood.
No.
So he's had to grow up quicker and therefore – and he's had to learn the rules of his existence quicker than a 16-year-old who's still futzing around with what they're going to do with their
there
life.
There is. Yeah, absolutely. But when you are a child and a 16-year-old, that's what you are and you haven't had to – you know, they're, sometimes what A was talking about just seemed too wise and I couldn't – I wouldn't accept the excuse that, well, he's just lived in so many bodies, he has perspective.
Fair point.
I mean, there's another one where he's talking to Rhiannon about Justin because he's not a very good boyfriend. And he's saying –
Justin, that is.
Yeah, Justin. And A is saying to Rhiannon, you only like him because he's a lost boy. And I've seen this happen so many times, but what happens to girls when they like lost boys is they become lost girls, which, again, it's a really wise thing to say and you read it and there's truth to it.
You know, I think Levithan
perfectly
captures his selfishness, how selfish he is as a 16-year-old boy or girl, or gender unknown, because he is very selfish.
Well, he's trying very hard not to be.
Yeah, but
I don't think that's a teenage thing. I think that's
he knowingly
a human
turns
thing.
Over a couple of people's lives just to get closer to Rhiannon. But can I just because I want to further unpack your point there about the wiseness, because one of the criticisms of the book, which is not my criticism, because I tore through this, I loved this book.
Oh, it's a really easy read.
It's an
his prose is beautiful.
It's easy. It's beautifully written.
Yeah,
I mean. One of the major criticisms
yes.
is that it's a didactic book, which it very much is.
It is.
It's
it
preachy.
Is.
It is, but it's didacticism. I don't know if that's a word on a level that I support because it's left leaning. I mean, it's very much about tolerance and very much about.
But in a way, it's not very complex. Like, you know, it's all tolerance, and it's everyone should just get along.
And that's what annoyed people.
Yeah.
But it's also reasonably anti-Christian as well.
The complexity is not really
It's
there.
Not pro-religion as a book.
No.
And so if you read certain people's comments about the book, especially if they've got a Christian –
in fact, it's one of the
– Christian bent. They're not, they feel it's too preachy, which I find ironic, but that's me showing my card. So
well, one of the things that A says that I marked is when A is talking about religion – where is it? Okay, I'll read the whole paragraph. It's only in the finer points that it gets complicated and contentious, the inability to realise no matter what our religion or gender or race or geographic background, we all have about 98% in common with each other. Yes, the differences between male and female are biological, but if you look at the biology as a matter of percentage, there aren't a whole lot of things that are different. Race is different purely as a social construction, not as an inherent difference. And religion, whether you believe in God or Yahweh or Allah or something else, odds are that at heart you want the same things. For whatever reason, we like to focus on the 2% that's different, and most of the conflict in the world comes from that. Which is kind of true, but it's also incredibly simplistic.
Very simplistic. I agree it is. You know, I agree it's extremely simplistic.
And, it's and this, I don't entirely... as you say, it's this left-leaning stuff yes. that reads as really nice and can't we all just get along and we're really all the same under the skin. But again, A is a teenager, and at times his when he goes on to a, not a rant, but a spiel like that, at times it reads as, oh, you're so young. But at times, it like with the childhood sacred thing, it reads as you're just, yeah, I can't buy that you'll be thinking like that. So
but he's
I don't
getting
know.
The points of view, admittedly within one town or one geographical area.
Yeah.
Of all these different cultures, all well, whatever culture
no,
exists in that.
Yeah.
It's a bit monolithic, I suppose, because if you're in white bread America, you're not going to get that many different points of view. But
yeah.
Still, I mean, look, the most powerful.
And as you say, I think you accept it because it.
Yeah,
fits in with your philosophy.
Correct, and I know I'm drinking the Kool-Aid when I'm reading this.
Drinking the Kool-Aid
because it absolutely does fit in. Even though I don't entirely agree with the assessment on religion, this whole idea that there's 2% that we don't agree with.
Yeah.
It's a bit more than that. But then you come to a chapter when he's in the mind of the suicidal girl.
That's a
which is harrowing.
It is,
and also didactic in a sense because it is very much about how we deal with mental health. In this society, which is not very well, especially parents, because a lot of it is about parents' reaction to children in this book and how parents don't seem to have a fucking clue in terms of how to deal with their kids, and especially this father dealing with his daughter and how and one of the rules he has is not to get involved, to literally just do the automatic things, go to school, you know, don't try and ups because he's only in their life for one day to do as little damage as possible. But in this case, because he knows that Rhiannon actually sort of pushes him, if I'm not mistaken, because I think he emails her and she says, well, don't you feel you should do something here? If you feel that she might self-harm or do something bad after you leave her body, don't you think you should try and get her help? And he's at first – now I'm saying he all the time. I apologize, but A is reluctant at first but then does it.
Because A's philosophy throughout all
is not
their
damage.
Body swapping is to not make any choices, not do anything, not experience anything that would – be really destructive to that person's life. Because the person whose body they're in, they remember their day, but they remember it as though it was their day.
Yes. And they remember it in a sort of cloudy sort of way. They know the events occurred.
And they kind of remember doing them or saying stuff or choosing to do stuff. And if it's too much outside of what they would normally be like, then there would be kind of – there would be a blip there. It'd be like, why did I do that? Why did I cut school and go to that party and that's – Yeah. So A tries to keep things neutral.
Yeah.
He just coasts along in that body and does what that person would normally do because A has access to the person's raw data.
Yes,
memories,
that's a key thing. And
not their emotions, not what they feel.
I'm not entirely thinking Levitt is clear
this
on
was,
this.
I've got to say, and I think the chapter on – I'm going to read the beginning of the chapter where A wakes up in the body of Kelsey Cook, who's the girl who's – suicidal.
Because I get the feeling that breaks the rules.
Now, the beginning...
Can I just say, I really think that this chapter, as much as I think it's amazing, it breaks the rules about the whole, he doesn't feel their emotions, just the raw data. Well, if that's the case, he shouldn't feel...
But he's not really... Anyway, let me read the beginning.
Read.
Some people think mental illness, and this is the very beginning of the chapter, this is how it opens, whereas a lot of the chapters open with, I'm here, I'm in this person, I wake up in the body of... blah, blah, blah. So this chapter opens with one of A's spiels. Some people think mental illness is a matter of mood, a matter of personality. They think depression is simply a form of being sad, that OCD is a form of being uptight. They think the soul is sick, not the body. It is, they believe, something that you have some choice over. I know how wrong this is. And then he goes on to talk a little about depression and so on, and then A has woken up in Kelsey Cook. And A says, Kelsey Cook's mind is a dark place. Even before I open my eyes, I know this. Her mind is an unquiet one. Words and thoughts and impulses constantly crashing into each other. My own thoughts try to assert themselves within this noise. The body responds by breaking into a sweat. I try to remain calm, but the body conspires against that, tries to drown me in distortion. And the only other time where he's really had a massive feedback from the body is when he was in the body of the addict.
Yes.
And he basically...
Another harrowing chapter.
Yeah, locked himself in the room and shut out the world for the day.
That I accepted a lot more because that is a physical... Addiction is a physical...
But he, and here
he's arguing that depression is
here
not
is,
based around emotion.
Here is what, at core, as much as I enjoyed reading the book and I think it has lots of interesting stuff to talk about and I do like it, at its core that I kept coming back to and that kept just jagging at me is that it's this very... late Western civilization idea of the mind being separate from the body, and that somehow...
Have you heard of Descartes?
Yeah.
That's exactly what Descartes said.
That's what I mean.
What do you mean, late civilization?
Well, it's not like, you know...
Dualism's been around for 500 years. What are you talking about? You're talking about late 20th century? You're talking about late as in...
I mean, we definitely have this idea in the last sort of very Western 20th century idea of this very New Agey, right?
It's New Agey, but it's not...
No, it's not. It's based on Cartesian philosophy.
Yes.
But this idea that we have who we are intrinsically as people is somehow completely independent of our physicality, and that it wouldn't matter which body we were in, like if we jumped bodies like A does, if we uploaded to a computer, if we're outside of our body somehow through astral traveling or whatever, that somehow we are intrinsically a person. The more we know about neuroscience and biology and how everything works is that is so patently untrue.
No, because people say, I'm playing devil's advocate, that you lose 21 grams when you die because the soul.
Oh, for God's sake.
I know it was a bloody... thingy film, but seriously, there is the view that the soul weighs 21 grams.
Well, he says it in that opening chapter. He talks about the soul.
Yeah,
he says as though the body is sick, as though the soul is sick and not the body.
The Cartesian view is extremely old fashioned.
Yeah,
it has a strong New Age link to it. But anyone who does mind body philosophy now, you know, Daniel Dennett and all those sorts and all those people, it's all about materialism and it's all about physicalism. There is no divide.
I mean, we do. We are the people we are to a great extent because of the bodies we inhabit, because of the chemicals in our bodies.
Yeah, but no one knows. We don't understand the mind.
No, we don't.
The problem I had wasn't that this is a Cartesian model. The problem I had was that I don't think he plays fair with the rules he sets up all the time.
I mean,
I'm asking you, as the depressed person, the girl, If he can't connect to their emotions, should he be feeling the same thing?
Well, he's not really feeling depressed. That's the thing. He is quite above and...
He can't get out of bed.
Well, he's more... He's frustrated. He does get out of bed.
He does, but he feels like he doesn't want... He does feel like... He says that her thoughts and thinking nearly as subsuming his, but that doesn't make sense with the other parts of the book. As much as I love that chapter, because I actually thought it was very...
It is a good chapter.
It actually made me quite cry.
And this is what I kept banging up against, because if... In that chapter, A really shouldn't have been able to get out of bed. He shouldn't have been able to think about... Because, you know, depression and mental illnesses are... an illness of the body.
Yes.
And to a lesser extent, every body he's in, and this is what I did, as much as the voice of the book, the voice of A is solid and uniform and it's a thing that carries you through, it's almost a cheat because really A should be very different in every body A is in.
Yeah, and this is the
And some bodies might just make him, you know, he should just be very different.
Absolutely.
That the body, the mind that A has gotten into, all of that,
and Levithan doesn't want that to happen. That's why he says he's only got access to the raw data,
because
not to the emotions.
He wants the cake and eating it as well,
correct,
essentially. He wants to be able to say that we are and when you cut everything away that he's cut away from A, you cut away your complete physicality. So anything related to biological gender, anything related to race, anything related to your weight or your height or anything like that is gone. That's gone. But then you also cut away personal preferences. You cut away sexual preferences,
for example.
But
that's why he wants to say we're all the same.
But when you cut all that away, what are you actually left with as a person?
And that's well, isn't that the whole thought experiment?
Yeah, what are you left
he's
with?
He's saying,
as a
well, I
and he's saying you're left with the core person, the essential person. Yeah. That's who
and
you're
that
left
person
with.
Is still a beautiful thing. And well, he's saying it's still a fully fledged person.
And I'm thinking that's no, because as people we are our physicalities. We are our bodies and the way our bodies interact in the world.
Arguing.
We are our preferences. We are our likes and our dislikes. We are our emotions. We are our mental states. We are all of this. All of this makes us who we are
so
and
what
changes
arguing,
who we are as we go through life.
What you're arguing, I know you're doing well, but what you're arguing is that an untethered personality like A should have been subsumed at some point. Because there's not enough.
There's who is A? You know, people like, on a very simplistic level, people like different foods, and their preference for food goes back to your own personal enzymes and chemicals that work in your mouth and your stomach, any allergies you may have, the foods you're actually exposed to as a child.
Yep.
All of that. A wouldn't have any of that. So even food preference, what does A like to eat? I'm also not convinced by A's educational standard because, honestly, this child would have the most fractured educational history.
Yes, he's often
you
proud
imagine,
at times when he's
and
when
yet,
he's got better knowledge than the person
he's
invited.
He's very literate. Yeah. He can do other people's homework when he's in their bodies most of the time. Sometimes he's better at them at stuff. So I'm saying he again, sorry. I'm kind of surprised A can even read, to be honest. Because, you know, unless you have this very reliable, continuous education, it's very hard to do things like learning to
we
read.
We are ripping this to shreds a bit, but it is
well,
– and you're right because it is, you're 100% right. Yeah. The Cartesian philosophy,
well,
the core
of this
doesn't
work. Well, I find it interesting because I really
work.
Did love yeah. – I kind of really liked reading the book, and yet the more I think about it, the more I think – well, actually, even while I was reading, I went, yeah, but that's a bit of a cheat, but here's a really nice paragraph. So I'm wondering how much the really beautiful writing and the surface philosophy, the aren't we all nice and can't we all get along, actually sort of – masks what is wrong with the book in a way, which is the underlying stuff, which is that we are somehow yeah. creatures of mind only, and the thing we think of as mind is not involved in the grey matter in our heads and the synapses and how they work,
yep.
and it's not involved in everything that makes us who we are, which is, you know, in a sense why A's demand that Rhiannon just see A and love A for what they are. Makes no sense because how do you when you love someone and Rhiannon does seem to love or to be falling in love with A at various points in the book. Sometimes she's not sure. Sometimes she
by the
says,
end, by the end though she's in love with A. No,
yeah.
by the end she's in love with the pureness that is A. She may not be in love with the bodies, but she's in love with.
Yeah.
By the end of the book clearly falls on the view.
Yes.
That there is a kernel to us all, to every single human being on this planet.
Yep. That is
that
some
we all
pure,
have. That is pure.
Some pure Ian.
And what
some
fucks
pure
it all
person.
Up is arbitrary external forces like religion.
Yeah.
Like this, that, and the other.
Like your body.
Like your body,
how
but
you
also
live.
External forces. Because religion, especially when we get the evil priests at the end and all this sort of stuff, which is a bit.
Well, he's not an evil priest. He's been.
He's
his
a body
body's
swapper
been
as well. Swapper as well. But it's played that way. Anyway, it's a bit naff. The external forces, whether it's political ideology or religion or whatever, that's what fucks it all up and takes that essential core. Our parents misunderstanding us and not bringing us up correctly and having strict regimes that don't make any sense.
Treating us differently.
Correct. That's what kills
and
the core beauty that is us.
And I would argue that all of that stuff is what makes you a person.
Us, yes. And I agree with you. You're
100%
right.
And makes you a distinct person and a unique person.
You're 100% right. And
because otherwise, aren't you just a disembodied voice
that's what
in
I'm
a
saying,
book?
The book. Because Rhiannon essentially is what we're arguing now. Mm. She's having the view. No, we are actually the more than just our soul. We're also the person which we embody. That also is integral to us.
And because it does something like one of the messages of the book,
it does raise some interesting views on transgender and transitioning. Because this is someone who transitions every day.
Yes.
Nearly. I mean, doesn't – it's not boy, girl, but often does transition. And I wasn't sure where to fit that into the
– I mean, A does towards the end inhabit a transgender boy.
That's right.
For a day. And that felt a little like ticking a box for the book. It looks quite a perfunctory kind of a chapter.
Yeah.
What A is experiencing, I think, is outside of – there will be some people who are on the gender / sexuality spectrum who might be as fluid as A presents, and they identify as neither male or female. They're attracted to any sexuality along the spectrum, and they are completely fluid as A presents.
Yeah, which is why what we're saying here could be quite offensive.
But
because we're talking about very much a cemented state of play. We're talking about a woman is a woman, a man is a man, body and soul are one and the same. And that's quite a concrete take on how we are.
Well, no, because I mean you can have different modes within that. I'm not saying that you have to be female or you have to be male or you have. I'm saying what you are, whatever that is, wherever that lies on the spectrum of personal expression and sexuality and gender, helps shape who you are. And it's why some people transition, because who they are is you know in conflict with how they're physically represented.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas A is never in any conflict with A's physical representation.
No, it takes it all for granted. And
because A doesn't identify with any physical representation.
No, that's true.
I mean, it's kind of like, it's that thing being like post-gender. Because A treats any type of physicality like wearing a set of clothing.
What did you think of the end?
Well,
I don't mean the Christian, the priest who's been upset, that A finds an equivalent A in the world.
Yeah.
And essentially says, Rhiannon, you should go out with this bloke because he's as close to me as you're going to get.
I thought that was really horribly self-serving.
Yeah, that's what I thought too. And yet I still love this book.
Yeah, I did not like the ending. I did not like, here, Rhiannon, I found someone who's as close to me as I can find and he'll be that person forever. Yes. So love him.
Yes.
Because that isn't how love. And in fact, if A believes what A's been saying all along, in that it's me and nothing else matters, then why would A think that she's going to love this other guy who A's found? You know? Because doesn't she love A?
I think what A is saying is that this guy.
Oh, I know. And all he's trying to find a substitute.
Is the closest to where the because he's so happy, this person.
Yeah.
And doesn't allow external forces. And so his core element is much brighter than a lot of the other people I've been in. And therefore, you'll see more of me in this person than you will anyone else, which sounds like a crock of convenient shit to me, but because it's extremely convenient.
And it's so presumptive. It's almost like, you know,
so like if
your
marriage.
Pet dies, yes. You know, you've got a cat that you've had for 10 years and your cat dies and someone gives you a kitten and you go, here's another one.
Yeah.
It's very like the other one
it's
had.
It's the same colour.
Without even any time to – and yeah, one day you might get another cat. But in the meantime, you want to mourn the cat that died.
Well, I don't think A is saying he's replaceable. I think he's saying that this is the – Rhiannon, this is the closest you're going to get to me in someone who doesn't swap bodies.
And maybe,
but it's convenient and it's
– it's convenient. And maybe Rhiannon would like to get someone completely different from A.
Well, that's right.
You know,
well,
it's not –
that's right.
I mean, which is why I don't think that relationship is actually going to work anyway. But
– can I ask one other question before we go move on to the next? Because it's something you mentioned
I did think
car.
It was a very – I think that was too much. I think A deciding to leave
– yes.
– is – was a good ending, I think.
But shouldn't have added
I think
on
the setup before A leaves is not a good ending.
Now, there's something you mentioned in the car. See, this is why I tell you don't talk about the books in the car.
Okay. What did I say in the
you
car?
You said, would if this was our Donna Levithan, would the sentimentality have gotten past as it does with a male?
See,
answer?
I'm not – and again, it's one of these things you never know, but I've read The Lover's Dictionary and I've read Every Day, obviously. I haven't read else of his work, but I mean he is a very sentimental writer, and I don't know, it seems like if it was by Donna Levithan, it may not be regarded as highly. It may be marketed more as girly fiction or chick lit, or you know, not something that's as well considered as the book is. And again, you don't know. So
it was
it's
an interesting thought experiment. Segue
because
into
his writing
our next
is
book.
Very sentimental.
It
and
is.
Actually, the other thing about this book that I kind of, you know, sometimes you read a book, and what you want is I call it the shadow book.
Yeah,
it's the book that's underneath that book.
Yes,
the book
yes,
that
yes.
you and I want like I really am interested in the shadow book to Every Day, because A's young and idealistic, and this is the first time A has actually fallen in love and lost someone. So now he's all, oh, no, I...
No, he's fallen in love before with a boy.
But that's...
Brennan.
But not someone he's physically got to spend time with.
Yeah, okay,
because
true.
That was an online thing.
Yep, fair point.
So this is the first time A's experienced a physical love, someone who A's got to spend time with over several days, not just one day and then talking on the internet or anything. It's very shallowly presented, but there comes a point where A is meets someone who tells A there is a way to continue to remain in the same body, at least for several days, if not the implication is maybe forever.
Yep.
So not to have to skip bodies every single day and to have some continuity and to have a life and to have a future, because A lives in the present. That's all A can do. And A thinks about it for, I don't know, 5 seconds and then decides, no, it's really bad. That's awful. Because whoever's body he took over would die.
Yeah.
Or at least become a...
Which is a fair statement.
Yeah, absolutely. But I kind of like to revisit A when A's, I don't know, 35, 40.
And see if he still holds dearly to that concept.
Yeah, or you know, if that's not now.
Because you think as an older guy, he would have got into a body where he says, well, this guy's just wasted it. He or she has just wasted their life.
You know, when you're a teenager,
I could do a better job. I'm going to stick.
Because when you're a teenager, you're often living in the present anyway. Yeah. I mean, the future's a very abstract concept. The idea of family and children and career and all that stuff is kind of there when you're 16, 17. Yeah. And I mean, I was certainly thinking about a career and everything when I was that age, but it's still very abstract, and it's certainly not something you miss yet because it's in the future. But if you're in your 30s and 40s, you've missed it, and every body that you're in now has usually a career. There will be children. You'll be experiencing being the parent at one step removed, instead of being the child with parents at one step removed, and. Yeah, I don't know. I don't give A another 20 years. A might not be as idealistic and might be more willing
I did wonder why, and this is probably the last things we'll say on the book because we need to move on, but I did wonder why we did get the revelation that there are others like A. What the purpose of that was.
I would have rather not
had that. I didn't see the need for
that.
It's part of that subplot that runs through the book, which we haven't really spoken about, which is the kid who he takes over and ends up on the side of the road.
It's setting
at midnight and then goes
crazy
and then thinks he's been possessed by devils. And there's all that whole subplot there, which is a bit annoying.
I think that's there to give a very significant choice to make. Does A continue in the life they've been given, or do they effectively murder someone
to
take over their body?
It takes 3 pages for A to make that decision.
And this is the thing, because the significant choice of this book isn't that, not of this book.
No, it's
maybe in a book 10 years down the track or 20 years. The choice in this book is what to do about Rhiannon.
That's right, which is why I don't want to know why he's put in this revelation, why he has that subplot about the kid who
and the choice that A make. I mean, well, it's bound in with that, because if A could take over another body, he'd be permanent and then him and Rhiannon could have a relationship. But it's almost giving him a very black and white way to be a very good person, right? Of course, I'm not going to murder someone to be with
me. But it makes it into a Star Trek book.
Yeah.
Where it's a black and white moral question
that has
to be answered.
The choice A makes is to not, with Rhiannon, who has fallen in love with him, because Rhiannon certainly sees A as a him, which is maybe why we do.
Yes.
Rhiannon has fallen in love with him, and she said, you know, this is really hard, because she can't introduce A to her parents or her friends. She can't integrate A into her life. So A makes the decision to move away, to get into a body which is going away and will no longer geographically pop up anywhere near Rhiannon. So that's the choice. And that's the choice. You don't need the bigger choice. You don't need the choice that impacts anyone outside of the book. You either care about the characters and the story in the book and what happens to them for their own sake. You don't need to worry that how it impacts the wider world.
Yeah. If it was me writing it, David, sorry, you don't need to get advice from me because I'm never going to be an author as good as you.
But
if you wanted to do what he did, you'd have A wake up in that body, the same body 2 days in a row. And realize, wait a sec, what's going on here? If you wanted to make that whole choice continuity issue.
I think that makes it more complicated.
Yeah,
he almost does that with waking up in the twins.
Yeah, which was I thought was quite
either
a
day.
Neat little thing.
But yeah, I feel like putting that in there opens up the shadow book to this one.
Yeah.
And that's maybe part of the reason I like this book, because that shadow book's there and I find that really interesting. And I would be really interesting in reading a book.
Yeah, but he doesn't have to write a sequel. It's fine.
you know, despite all that, I did like the book. And part of the
– I highly recommend people read it.
Part of the thing that I liked about it is – all of this discussion that makes you think about all this stuff.
It provokes discussion.
And I mean, the fact that I really disagree vehemently with the separation of the mind-body worldview, it made me think about why I disagreed with it. Why wasn't I buying this floating version of some essential A? I mean, why is it? Why? And it makes you think about everything that makes shitty. You and the people you love.
I get shitty when people give a book 1 out of 5 or 2 out of 5 because they – argue with the central core of the novel, yeah. but forget the fact that that's actually the purpose of the book.
It's the purpose of the book.
And that's why we read. We don't always read to agree with every single thing that we're reading. We read because we want to be, you know, see new ideas, new concepts. And we may not accept them all. And yes, they'll make us think and they'll make us re-evaluate our own prejudices and blah, blah, blah. And to give it 1 star because I don't agree because it's all too didactic for me.
I think, as I said, we've talked about the problems we have with the book, but I think it's a really interesting book, and it makes you think. It makes you question your assumptions about things. Yes. Even if you retain some of those assumptions, you've sort of interrogated why you hold them. Yes. They're not just lazy things you're thinking.
Yes.
You really sit down and think, well, why do I think the mind-body is one thing? Why? So anyway, good book.
So, what did you think about the next book?
What is the next book, Ian?
It's The Woman Upstairs by Claire Massoud.
Which you recommended.
I did.
I really loved it. This is a book I loved. This is a book I really loved. Though, again, didn't agree with everything in it, but really loved this book.
Now, this is a non-genre book.
Yes.
I don't know why I keep mentioning that, because writing the critic can look at any sort of books.
Yes, we can. Good books.
Yes, that's the main thing, good books, not necessarily genre, though to be fair, most of them will be. Anyway, I picked this because it was mentioned, as I think I said in the last podcast, on both the New York Times Book Review podcast and Books on the Nightstand podcast. They both mentioned it within a week or so of each other and praised it to the hilt. Well, actually, I think the first one it might have been an interview with Claire, the New York Times one. But in any case, highly praised book, and I thought, well, you know, why not? It's a sort of book I wouldn't normally read. It's a sort of book I would go nowhere near. In fact, this is critical to the book,
yep.
because it's the sort of book I'd expect my mum or mother-in-law to read. Yes.
Ooh.
Yes, exactly. And it's exactly that thinking that got me reading the book, because I thought, well, what the fuck does that even mean?
Yep.
But that's how it felt.
Yep.
Anyway, what's it about?
Very quickly.
Nora is a 30 – and I'm reading this from Goodreads, so yeah. Nora is a 37-year-old elementary school teacher in Cambridge, Massachusetts, is on the verge of disappearing. Having abandoned her desire to be an artist, she has become the woman upstairs, in air quotes. A reliable friend and tidy neighbor, always on the fringe of others' achievements. Then into her classroom walks a new pupil, Reza Shahid, a child who enchants as if from a fairy tale. He and his parents, Dashing Skander, a half-Muslim professor of ethical history born in Beirut, and Serena, an effortlessly gracious Italian artist, have come to America for Skander to teach at Harvard. And things go on from there. I mean, there's more to the blurb, but I'm not going to go into it. But essentially, a relationship is then created or forged between Nora and this family through the son, Reza, who gets bullied at one point, and that's where – and has to go to hospital and gets hurt. She has to go talk to Serena, and that's where the link occurs. And it also happens that Serena is an artist, an installation artist, and, of course, that triggers for Nora her own desire to be an artist. And
yeah.
They hire out a warehouse for them both to do art, and it goes from there. But essentially this is about the relationship between a woman who – could be deemed by the book and by others as a discard. She's had her chance at life, and now all she is a washed up.
Yeah,
has
at,
been
at 37. Oh what, dear.
Yeah, at 37 exactly. What's the quote that Jennifer Weiner says, which we'll get to in a second.
We'll get to that.
Yeah, maybe I shouldn't say.
First,
that.
I'm just going to read a paragraph from the book, which to explain the title. In a way.
Okay.
And so it's a first person narrative. So you have Nora, and she's telling this story from a few years down the road, in retrospect. And she's very much telling the story. I don't know if she's written a book, but she's telling a story.
Yes.
So here's how she talks about herself and women like her as she sees them. We're always upstairs. We're not the mad women in the attic. They get lots of play one way or another. We're the quiet woman at the end of the third floor hallway whose trash is always tidy, who smiles brightly in the stairwell with a cheerful greeting, and who, from behind closed doors, never makes a sound. In our lives of quiet desperation, the woman upstairs is who we are, with or without a goddamn tabby or pesky lolloping Labrador, and not a soul registers that we are furious. We're completely invisible. I thought it wasn't true, or not true of me, but I've learned I am no different at all. The question now is how to work it, how to use that invisibility to make it burn. And that's...
By the way, if that writing is gorgeous, and that's what it is like through the whole book.
Oh, the book is really well written. It's so quick to read. Nora is such an engaging narrator. It's actually, there's funny because I read a review, an interview with Claire Massoud, and she was talking about the book, and I'm just going to read out this little answer that she gave. She says, people say, oh, it's a book about an angry woman. And I say, well, she's angry at the beginning, which is also the end. But her anger is actually a response to how joyful and full of wonder and discovery and hope this time was in her life and what she feels that she's at risk of losing or may have lost. I do feel I have to remind people, or else they think it's just 200 pages of yelling.
I've seen people put their criticism in is, oh, it starts
it's
so angry.
It's just an angry book. It's just a book about an angry woman.
They go, it starts so angry, but then it doesn't sustain it because she seems happy at times. You think, no, well, that's you don't get, that's the fucking point of the novel.
Because she's writing from the end of the story.
Yeah, but it's more than that. This is a woman who, self-aware, already thinks that she's possibly missed her opportunity with life, okay?
Yeah.
She's given an opportunity through this couple that she comes across to reinvigorate herself.
Yeah.
And then she is betrayed. Well, she believes she's betrayed.
Oh, she's totally betrayed.
Well, I'm not as convinced. Not as convinced, but she definitely, whether I am or not, she definitely.
I don't see how you can't be. We'll get to that.
Yeah. That leads into one of my other arguments, but she definitely believes she's betrayed, and that then is where the anger stems from. But there's also there is the view, though, even before she meets this this couple, that there's still the simmering. There's still, because she feels that she is left over, essentially.
Yeah.
And has missed her opportunity. There's going to be frustration and anger there as well. But it's not going to be – I know people thought this was going to be a novel about, like that film where he gets out of the car and goes to the McDonald's and starts shooting people.
Oh, that stupid Michael Douglas film.
Yeah,
Falling Down.
Yeah, Falling Down. People thought she was just going to – that this woman was just going to crack and start murdering people and slaughtering them.
I think
they missed the point of the fucking novel.
I think the balancing act that Massoud does with this book, and does it exceedingly well, is she has this character who at the point she's telling her story is furious.
Yes.
And will hopefully, we hope, be using that anger for something after she finishes telling her story. But she does it's not something that seeps through the whole book. And when Nora is telling us about what happened in her past, she is conveying the as Claire Massoud said, the joy and the sense of wonder and the passion that is conveyed beautifully on the page, and it's not soured by her like a retrospective bitterness or anger when she's telling us about the past. She's living in that moment,
correct?
And she's reliving that for us,
correct? However, can I quote one thing? Because there are moments when the anger does come out, when she says things like, because before the Shahids, I thought I understood love and what it was and how I felt about it, and they turned it all upside down. The very fact that I can tell you without blinking that I could kill them, that above all I could kill her, says all that needs to be said. Oh, don't worry, I won't. I'm harmless. We women upstairs are that too, but I could.
Mm.
And there's this sudden shift, because that scene actually happens when she's talking about that this is during the burgeoning of the relationship and that joy and that living in the moment and it's that happiness. And then there's a sudden moment, which I've just read,
she does,
where she says, I actually, right now today, telling you this story, I could actually go and kill them both.
Yeah. Well, she does. It's not like
– But it's a punch in the face.
Yeah, but it's not like, here's my angry prologue and now here's the story and here's my angry epilogue.
Yeah.
Like, she's very much telling you the story all the way through, but when she is relating
she reminds you that the anger is there, that this is not –
But she is relating how she felt at the time. She conveys that joy and the love and all of that. beautifully. And it's wonderful the way she teases you throughout the novel, because you're not, you don't know until what the betrayal and this is what has happened.
The corker is, you think you know, you think once a certain event occurs, about 2/3
yeah,
of the way
you
through,
think that's...
We're going to spoil this, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. We've spoiled
it. When she has an affair yeah. with the husband, you think, well, that's it.
It is a weird affair. And I do wonder, I'm like, and he, oh, I detest Serena.
Are you getting angry?
Yeah, I'm getting angry. I'm all went upstairs.
I don't think you're that likable at the moment, Kirsten. We'll get to that point in a second. By the way, you could tell when I love a book because my voice goes up an octave. I just wanted to mention.
Because
that.
Her quote-unquote affair with Skander and her relationship with Skander. See, I think except for the boy Reza, who, because he's a child, he's not using her in a way that his parents are definitely using Nora. And so with Reza, she gets this sort of maternal love experience that she hasn't had. And her relationship with Serena is one that sort of unlocks her creativity. And Serena is sort of who she wants to be. Serena is the life she would have liked to have had. And, you know, it's no accident that Serena is Serena Siren.
You did this with the Helen Marshall with the angels, and you saw Helen Marshall came back and said, "Yeah, you're spot on, Kirsten."
A character says that in the book. One of her friends says,
"I missed that."
Calls her the Siren.
I was waiting for the bit where she starts shooting people. I missed all that.
And Skander's relationship with Nora is also very selfish. He's using her as this.
As a father, as a confessor, she's a confessor role because he tells her.
But more than a confessor, he's using her as, or she feels that she's getting intellectual stimulation from the talks they have, because he will walk her home after her babysitting.
Oh, actually, that's point.
Talk,
yeah, because
right?
it's more a patronising thing.
It's more patronising. It's more Skander getting to talk about his stuff and having someone there as,
because he realises Serena won't listen anymore.
Not even a sounding board, because she's not.
Yep.
You know, she's less than a sounding board. She's just someone he gets to expound to and who will receive that.
Yeah, that's right.
Accept me with grace and gratefulness.
Because his wife doesn't care.
Because his wife.
she's caught up in her installation. She doesn't want to hear shit about Lebanon.
And as much as Nora, she is attracted to Skander. Her attraction to Skander develops a sexual, but she doesn't do anything about it. It's Skander who comes to the loft to seduce her, and it's never quite articulated exactly what happens there. It's intimated that actually nothing really happens.
It's pretty much intimated that
there's a line in there where she talks about how it never quite went that far, but they certainly fooled around.
Okay.
Right? And I do wonder if Serena didn't send him there to get that footage. Like, I do wonder if it wasn't a setup and if that footage isn't floating
around
somewhere
else. You're getting
really
angry.
Because the relationship that these two people have with her is really so, and hers, like, she's getting something too, but it's so one-sided to them.
You see, I don't agree.
Oh, I do think Serena or Skander went there to get back at Serena.
Death of the author aside, Claire Massoud does say, and it actually was the New York Times Book Review interview, she says that these, as you've properly discussed, these three people are filling in holes in her life.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay?
Absolutely.
And that's what she's getting
and
from them.
And in fact, Claire Massoud says that's what friends do anyway.
Yeah,
we all have friends and all
that's
our friends
what friends and partners do. They fill gaps in our
But she becomes obsessed with them. She becomes utterly obsessed with them. When they don't ring her or don't do this, she begins to get paranoid and worried.
Well, especially
what's happened.
Serena.
Yes, correct.
Serena's the focus.
Correct. This is before the affair. This is before that
absolutely.
Point. She becomes, and yes, they do use her. There's no doubt about it. But she uses them as well to a degree, to a big degree. Because she's at a point in her life where she feels that that's it. She's done. Now suddenly there's this horizon of love and joy and she thinks, I want that.
Yep.
Give it to me.
But when you say she uses them, that's a really loaded term. Because thinking about the novel and what happens in the novel, just name one thing that Nora ever does or doesn't do which inconveniences or disrupts the lives of
nothing
or anything to
no, fair
any
point.
Of
fair
that
point.
Family.
No, fair point.
She is obsessed. She does genuinely love them, and I don't think it's necessarily a psychopathic love, but she's the one giving.
Yeah, but just because she's playing the martyr in this relationship,
I'm
doesn't mean
not.
That she's not getting.
No, I'm not saying that, but she's not using them. Well, they are definitely using her. They are getting stuff from her that they otherwise wouldn't get. I mean, Serena is getting half her loft shared, and as we found out, she's getting a subject for her artwork. Scandals, they're getting a free babysitter. They are definitely taking advantage of Nora's obvious infatuation with this family. And that would still all be fine because relationships are unbalanced and you will get people in a relationship who may be getting more out of the relationship than another person is and so on. And that's human. We have very few perfectly equal relationships in our lives. And that's not necessarily a bad thing. But what they do to her explicitly shows that they are using her. And I don't think they actually care for her much at all as a person, as a friend.
Okay.
I mean, Serena becomes emblematic of how Nora talks about male artists or artists, and by default male artists, as they've mostly been celebrated, being ruthless and obsessive, and that you have to be.
Can I just say one thing?
Yeah.
Those dioramas she was making, did you not, wish you could see them? The ones that Claire were making.
Yeah.
Didn't they sound like the most amazing things in the
yeah,
world?
Yeah.
Anyway, keep going.
Sorry. No, I was just saying, I mean, how artists have to be it's the usual thing, right? Ruthless and focused and have to sacrifice other people and things, which is, again, when you're young, when you're in your teens and 20s, it's this romantic thing of, yes, artists must spurn everything and focus on the art and it's bullshit. It's complete bullshit. I think to make true art, whatever your art is a communication with other people. And if you are sacrificing other people to your art, that's bullshit.
Yeah, okay. And I know
it is bullshit.
And based on that, I can see how the betrayal.
You know, you have to be part of humanity.
Can I tell you why what's the betrayal? Yeah. She's filmed because in this installation, there are cameras everywhere. It's part. The installation is.
It's based on
Alice in Wonderland. That's right. But we're not going to go into detail on the installation because you can read the book. But there's cameras everywhere. And at one point.
Well, when it's being built, there aren't cameras. Nora doesn't know there are cameras as it's being built in the loft. Cameras were going in were when the children
correct.
Were being
Correct. The whole
built.
Point of the cameras is to get the reactions of the children
but
and
then
replay the loops.
She had no idea
screens.
There were cameras before the children came in.
And in the cameras.
And in one of the nights where she was in the loft alone, because Serena did not come every night because she would often work during the day.
She goes to the installation.
She gets drunk. She dresses up as who does she dress? Oh, Edie Sedgwick.
Yeah.
And dances around the loft and has a moment of 18-year-old girlishness and ends up masturbating in the installation.
Yes, that's exactly right.
And which sounds a lot seedy that it's actually presented. She interacts with the art.
Now, you could say that's a betrayal of the art that's going on, mocking the art by wanking.
But she's not mocking it. That's the thing. She's not mocking it. She's interacting with it.
In
she's
any case,
in love
the betrayal
with the
installation. Is that
because she's not doing it out of derision or dismissal. She loves Serena's work. She's in love with Serena's work almost as much as she's with Serena.
Yeah,
Say
what the betrayal is, because
so unbeknownst to Nora, Serena had set up cameras and was filming. And as she says later, there must have been motion sensors or something because Serena wasn't there during that. She couldn't have set the cameras up and just forgot they were running. I mean, she's deliberately set them up to capture
a moment, yeah,
which is becomes part of the later installation work when it's in galleries. Which is why I do think that when Skander went, I think he knew.
Because they didn't know at that point that she had masturbated in the installation. So Skander might have been used to get her into the installation so they could take, which is, if you think of it that way, that's fucking vile.
It's
but anyway,
really vile.
Keep going.
It's really vile. And Nora doesn't know about any of this. She doesn't know about any of this until much, 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 much later, years after Serena and Skander and Risa have gone back to Paris and Serena his career has taken off and the Wonderland installation was a great thing and part of what's being sold, because it's an installation, you can't sell the artwork, but what's being sold is limited edition footages of people walking through the installation while it's being displayed at various museums. And Nora goes into a gallery that Serena doesn't tell her about that's showing some of this footage and selling the limited edition tapes. And she sees herself, that footage from that night, and it's part of the work. And Serena's never mentioned it to her, never asked her permission, never I mean, it's the most mundane thing, but you can see why it. I mean, it is awful. It's awful. It's absolutely awful. And you know, and Serena knows it's awful because she's never told Nora or asked her permission to use it.
Interestingly, the relationship. See, I thought this event, this betrayal, would occur at the height of the relationship, but Masood is far too smart.
Well, it did. She just didn't know. And that's the beautiful thing.
Well, no, but that's where I'm saying Masood is far too smart for us.
Yeah.
They've left. Years have passed.
Yeah.
The relationship has lost its luster. It's no longer what it was.
Yeah, exactly. They're back in Paris.
Even when she goes to visit them before she's seen.
Yeah. Well, this is the trip she goes to
visit. There isn't the same connection anymore.
Yeah, no.
Okay.
And Reza's grown up.
He cares less. You know, yeah. The luster is gone. And yet she sees this and. It's an explosion
because it's that thing. It's like
because you treasure the moments where something special happened and it just destroys it.
And that's it. Because
yeah, I understand.
And the tragic thing for Nora is yes, in the throes of her varying relationships with the family, she did get a little obsessive, but she let it. Like when they went to Paris and she was a bit hurt that Serena didn't seem to feel as sad that their friendship would obviously now be drawing to an end because they would be continents apart. And, you know, the emails trickled off. And she accepted that in much the same way as she accepted everything else in her life as this is just what life is. She didn't get upset. She didn't pursue them. Well, her trip years later was she was taking a tour to Europe and she thought, well, while I'm over there, I'll stop in Paris. I'll see them. We'll catch
but
up.
That, I'm saying that's the genius. The luster is worn off.
Yeah.
And here is that dagger in the heart.
But, I mean, that's what's so awful because she wasn't mooning for years and years, oh, if only. I mean, she'd accepted that and she was happy to have had this really nice year.
Yeah,
and that's what she had. She was looking at it as this almost like one of her
I might be the
one
woman
of her
upstairs.
Dioramas,
I'm
right?
Not,
it was it was this year that she had that was beautiful and she experienced all of this stuff and she could just have that. And what Serena has done is taken that away from her.
Yeah,
look, she's taken that away.
You're right, you're right.
And it's horrible because she couldn't even leave Nora with that. It was so important for her to use this bit of footage to finish her artwork that she didn't care. Obviously, she was assuming Nora might not find out.
Could it have been a punishment for having an affair with her husband?
No.
See, that, you're convinced of that.
Yeah.
I that's why I was less convinced it was a betrayal because I thought, well, you've – yes, Skander
because she didn't have an affair with him.
Well
– they had an adult intellectual relationship.
Which involved kissing and touching and – potential ejaculation.
One night when Skander came and seduced her.
But it happened.
And then it never happened again and she didn't pursue him and she didn't
do anything. But it happened.
Yeah, it happened.
And we don't
know.
Serena might have thought, well, fuck you. It wasn't as clear to me. I hear what you're saying and I agree with you and you've turned me the other way. But at the time I was reading, I thought, well, there has been a you're not as clean as you make out to be, Nora.
She's not.
You've dirtied your hands as well.
And she says
that. Yeah, I understand that, but, you know, you've dirtied your hands as well. To feel that you would now literally go back to the house and kill them both for what they've done to you. You say you won't because you're the woman upstairs. But
she could.
That you could actually go up and knife both of them to death or shoot them or whatever. It felt a bit, I'm going to say this word, you're not going to like it, melodramatic. Melodramatic, given that she was not clean herself.
That's quite a gendered reading.
Yes, I know. I know. But can I?
Okay, but what... Here's the reason why they're not equal.
Okay.
Because at the core of this of the story, Reza and Skander are the secondary relationships that both Nora and Serena have. The primary relationship Serena has is with her art.
Yep.
And the primary relationship that Nora has is with Serena.
Yep.
And through Serena, Nora is trying to recapture, and it's very clear in the book that she's not just a middle-aged woman who has this idea that maybe she'd like to be an artist one day. I mean, she has practiced art. She went to art college. She has just had to give up that career because, as she says, she didn't have the luxury to be that ruthless. She had a mother to take care of. She had a career to do. She could have been.
Well, it was no. It's her
but
mother, Rosa. She was taking care
person,
of her mother. So,
right, but she would be a different person if she'd pursued an artistic career at the expense of her family and so on. But she is at heart an artist, and that's how she sees the world. And that's she tries to create or to rekindle that. that artist's experience through Serena, and she makes the dioramas of the, what I call in my head, the mad women and the dead women and the dead mad women. so it's Virginia Woolf and
Emily Dickinson.
Emily Dickinson and Alice Neal, the Spanish painter.
Yeah.
And Edie Sedgwick, who's not an artist, who was the muse, the glamour girl, the peripheral, the throwaway girl of Andy Warhol's factory. A horribly tragic story.
There's a documentary on it, isn't there?
Oh, probably.
And there's a film, I think. But anyway,
there's definitely a film. And what Serena has done is she's taken Nora the artist and made her Edie Sedgwick.
Yeah.
She's put her there. She it's the exhibitionist nature of it. It's on that night, Nora was dressed herself up as Edie Sedgwick. She was taking photos of herself to something she may wanted to do that she discarded because she decided it was childish. So Serena has taken Nora, who desperately was using that year to do art, and to try and rekindle within herself the artist that she could maybe have a career with, and Serena has made her Edie Sedgwick. It's awful. It's so, and Serena would know. I mean, it's awful. It's an awful, awful thing because she's not just betrayed.
And you still don't see anything wrong with the non-affair.
No, I know there's something wrong with, and Nora acknowledges there's something wrong, but it's not at the same level because
okay, all right, fine.
Because Serena doesn't actually care that much. I mean, she doesn't.
Well, we don't know that.
It's quite obvious. What she cares about is her art.
I know that, but we don't know that she doesn't care. Because we know she's obsessed with her art that's all we really see of Serena. We don't know. If she didn't care, Nora would have said to her, look, I might have fooled around with Scandal there.
Oh, well, she's not going to – they're not – I mean, you don't say these things, do you? What I'm saying is, yes, that was a betrayal, but it's a lesser one.
All right.
It's a lesser one than what Serena has done.
Well, I'll let the readers decide.
The readers.
But I wanted to bring one thing to – before we get into the gender discussion, which is the next bit, I did want to bring one thing to about the – I'm going to get this tongue-tied – fetishization.
Yes.
Say that. Can you say it?
Fetishization.
Fetishization. Will you say it?
The fetishization of
Middle Eastern culture here and exoticness, because it's no coincidence that Skander is an expert in Lebanon and was half Muslim, and Reza is this sort of fair, as the blurb says, this sort of beautiful fairy tale child. Serena herself is Italian, but you know, obviously has a. There's this Middle Eastern feel, this sort of exoticness that goes, and she does fetishize them as the story goes, especially Reezy gets fetishized a lot throughout the book. And that did make me feel extremely uncomfortable, given what you've just said in the last 10, 15 minutes, that essentially the baddies are the Middle Eastern people at the end. I mean, I know I'm simplifying it like Tony Abbott did with our Syria, baddies versus baddies, but the abuse is coming from the culture that's been fetishized throughout the novel, which I found.
Yeah, no, I can see that.
I found uncomfortable.
Yeah, I can
because
see
because she is the white woman who has gone into their life, seen them as exotic, and even if Sue doesn't use that terminology, it's pretty clear to me that they're an exotic part of her life that she craves and obsesses about.
Yeah.
And then they turn.
Well, she romanticizes them.
Yeah, but I think it's an exotic thing too.
But that's why.
And then they turn on her, and she feels anger for her. And I know it's a long bow to talk about, you know, America's view on the Middle East at the moment, and that. But I did wonder whether this was an attempted commentary on the Middle East, with what this said about diversity in America. I haven't fleshed it out in my own head.
I think it's more, if anything, I mean, it's more, I think, the European versus American thing, because they're European, they're based in Paris, as you say, Serena's by way of Italy, and it's very much the European.
You think it's more European than Middle Eastern?
I think it's more, because that's how they've set them up. They've set themselves up, and that's where they live. I mean, Skander talks a lot about.
Skander doesn't live in Beirut.
No. He talks a lot about Lebanon.
Yeah, but he doesn't live there, and there's probably a good reason why he doesn't live there.
Yeah. They've got the expat European vibe happening. And I think that maybe that's more the dynamic that's in play with the Americans.
That's it, okay.
But I'm not sure. I mean,
I haven't fleshed it out in my own head, but I did wonder, and I don't think Masood's trying to be racist here or anything like that, but it did feel like there was a rejection of the Middle East in some of this, that the Middle East have betrayed us as much as these people have betrayed us, which is a fucking long bow, and that's why I'm not fleshing it out.
Bit of a long bow.
It is a long bow, I know, but it did rankle with me. It was the only thing that rankled with me in the whole book.
Because, I mean, really it all revolves around Serena. And Serena is very much Paris, European, art world. Pretension, expat, all of that stuff. It's all of that stuff which is posited against the Nora's very much middle American, controlled. Even her artwork is very controlled.
So you see it as America versus Europe rather than America versus the Middle East.
Well, I don't really. Seen it as that. But
if there
think,
is that,
yeah.
if there is that dichotomy, that's how you.
It's the sort of the dilettante. Conceptual European artist flitting about the globe, making their obscure, hard to understand
again,
artworks.
I'd be interested to hear what others think.
But yeah, no, I mean, Skander is originally Lebanese and he is an associate professor when we meet him at one of the universities specializing in Lebanese affairs. And that's one of the things he talks to Nora about is the history of his.
Yeah, and it's all
country.
Great stuff.
So it's all there.
It did leave that. Sour taste, but that was about it. Now, can we get into the gender stuff? Otherwise we'll talk about this novel for the next 4 hours.
Stuff. Well, this is what you said to me. You said this last podcast, you read the book, you've got to read all the stuff around the book.
And you thought, what the fuck is
Modern about? I emailed you and said, what are you talking about? And funnily enough, I had actually come across the fallout a little bit and just bookmarked it.
It was a Publisher Weekly interview?
It was a Publisher Weekly interview. I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with the interview or the question. I think that's fine, and I don't think there's anything wrong with their answer. It's interesting how it sparked off so much debate. But basically the Publishers Weekly interviewer, who was Anna Sue McCleave Wilson, she talked to Claire Masood about, you know, why she wrote the book and her inspiration, all that usual stuff. And Masood was saying she was thinking about the books that she really liked and the characters that she really connected with, and they were, you know, the angry characters, the characters who railed against some aspect of society and were eloquent and, you know, not just ranty, but were eloquent in their anger and all of that. And she realised they were all male characters and books by men. And she said, anyway, these books I love, they're all books by men, every last one of them. Because if it's unseemly and possibly dangerous for a man to be angry, it's totally unacceptable for a woman to be angry. I wanted to write a voice that, for me, as a reader, had been missing from the chorus, the voice of the angry woman. And one of the lines that she said I really love, one of the reasons she loves these types of books is because rage at life and rage for life are very closely linked. To be angry, you have to give a shit.
Yeah.
Which is true.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you're not passionate about the stuff, you're not going to be angry. You're just like, oh, whatever.
Yeah.
You know. So then the interviewer asked her a question that seemed to spark everything off across the interwebs. And she said, I wouldn't want to be friends with Nora, would you? Her outlook is almost unbearably grim. And I'm just going to read Claire Masood's response in full. I'll also link to this interview. For heaven's sake, what kind of question is that? Would you want to be friends with Humbert? Would you want to be friends with Mickey Sabath, Salim Sanai, Hamlet, Crap, Oedipus, Oscar Wow, which I would actually like to be friends with Oscar Wow.
Oscar Wow's awesome.
Raskolnikov, any of the characters in The Corrections, any of the characters in Infinite Jest.
Yeah, a couple of those.
Any of the characters in anything Pynchon has ever written, or Martin Amis, or Orhan Pamuk, or Alice Munro for that matter. If you're reading to find friends, you're in deep trouble. We read to find life in all its possibilities. The relevant question isn't, is this a potential friend for me, but is this character alive? Nora's outlook isn't unbearably grim at all. Nora is telling her story in the immediate wake of an enormous betrayal by a friend she has loved dearly. She's deeply upset and angry, but most of the novel is describing a time in which she felt hope, beauty, elation, joy, wonder, anticipation. These are the things her friends gave to her, and this is why they mattered so much. Her rage corresponds to the immensity of what she has lost. It doesn't matter, in a way, whether all these emotions were the result of real interactions or a fantasy. She experienced them fully, and in losing them, has lost happiness.
That's an awesome answer.
It's an awesome answer. But it does speak to the socialization of girls and women as being required to be less emotional, more passive, not angry, accommodating. The woman upstairs.
It does speak to all that. Those but things. Doesn't it also speak upstairs. To a terrible reading of the book? This is the thing that got me. The reading
yes,
of the book.
Yes, that Norma's outlook is, I think by the end of the book, Nora's outlook is far from unbearably grim. I think it's, I'd love to see what she, I don't want to see what she does next, but I love thinking about what she might do next.
Yeah, but it's a reading of, oh, well, she's not likable.
Yeah,
she
she's
wouldn't
not
want to be
likeable.
My friend. That's such a narrow reading of the book because it also implies,
I actually would love to be Nora's friend.
It also. And I do wonder whether the hype about this book got people thinking that this is just about a woman who's angry.
An angry woman.
Yeah. The last page.
And one of the comments, which I know you shouldn't read the comments. Well, actually, you should.
No, I think you should read the comments.
But one of the comments, which I read twice and I thought, is this performance art? Because it's so clearly making the point that Claire Massoud is making. So it's from, well, the name given is William Souter, and the avatar face is of an older white gentleman with glasses, all we can say. And he said, Claire Massoud is certainly entitled to take umbrage at a question she finds tedious or objectionable, but I fail to see how this was either. If Massoud wanted to make a point about expectations and double standards where women characters are concerned, she could have done so more graciously. If she thought the question was stupid or insensitive, she might have found a way to improve it with a more generous answer.
That's a corker.
Rather than making the poor reporter feel that she too was stupid and insensitive. Later on he says, because someone comes back and says, I didn't actually see it that angry, which you don't, it doesn't, you know, it's not as though like, oh, I'm full of rage.
No,
she's not an angry answer.
She's been cutting.
She's frustrated.
Yeah,
it's
exactly.
Like, oh, for goodness sake.
But even if she was angry, yeah. Who gives a fuck?
But anyway, he said, so William Souter again on Facebook says, I'm not saying she shouldn't make the point, just that her anger seems disproportional. It's a question of tone.
Yes.
And I think it's rarely a good idea to put yourself in company with the likes of Shakespeare, Nabokov, etc., unless you are like them, fixtures in the canon.
Oh, my God.
No. Oh my God. It's just beautiful. And then he comes back again a bit later because people keep saying, come on.
Did you refer this guy at the end?
No.
Did you think about it?
It came off the...
but you could have found him and said, I want to friend you because you're funny.
And then he says, because people are talking about, well, you know, she's allowed to be frustrated and she's, you know, blah, blah, blah. And he says, and then there's this. I don't know this for sure, but this looks like a Q&A in which the answers were written, I would imagine, as email responses, which I agree with him. That would introduce a degree of calculation in Massoud's response that makes it seem less righteously indignant and perhaps more self-serving. So
you can't write
so the
angry,
only way women are allowed to be angry is if it's off the cuff.
Yeah, off
just,
the cuff, spontaneous, yeah.
You know, if you've actually had time to sit down and think about your written responses, you should be much more gracious
like
and
men.
Generous and calm, and it's a question of tone.
Yes, of course.
It's beautiful. It's just illustrates the point. I mean, for goodness sake, John Franzen has a book out very soon, if not out already, where he's just ranting about everything, what makes him angry, what he hates. That's perfectly fine because it's John Franzen. Men get to be angry. Men get to rant. Men get to
or the very
diatribe.
Worst, people could just roll their eyes and go, oh, well.
Yeah.
But no one's going to get upset.
No one says, oh, John, I think you could have been a bit more gracious about what you've said. I understand you're a bit upset about Twitter, but, you know. it's really – and this is exactly what she's writing the book about. I mean, Nora has – fashioned her entire life around being the woman upstairs, the good girl.
Who calculates her responses, just like William Souter wants.
Exactly, who thinks about, you know, what would people be upset by this? How can I live my life and present myself and interact with people in a way that makes people like me?
Yeah.
That makes people think I'm a nice person. And she is a nice person. But this
well,
is
that's
the problem.
The
Once
thing.
A woman gets angry, she's like, she's not a nice person. She's shrill. She's a harpy.
What's
she's,
not likable about
I
it?
I think Nora is incredibly likable. I really
and not
did
that that's
like
the
her.
Point, and not that she needs to be, and not that.
But it is the point. It is
no,
the
no,
point
no,
to
no,
say. No,
no, no. It isn't because I would still have loved this book if she was a so-called harpy or shrill or whatever other gender terms people use.
I think I might have liked it less because I think it might have come off as a very one note.
Well, that's possible. I agree.
Harpish book, right?
Absolutely.
But the fact is that she is a very fleshed out character. She has friends who do like her for who she is.
That's right.
She genuinely likes her job and her the kids that she teaches. She genuinely loves her father. I mean, she's very busy in her life and feels a bit bad. She doesn't spend as much time with him.
Yeah, that's it. She's a fully fledged human being. All of this
stuff. But as soon as you say, well, she's a woman who's angry about stuff and feels betrayed and is expressing that, that makes her not likable. Like, it's really disturbing. Why should a woman have
Why wouldn't you want to be friends with Nora? What has Nora done in this book that you wouldn't want to be friends with her? That she's upset?
She's loves people too her crime, much. She's been too naive. Correct. She's been too naive.
Well, her crime is that she went into a gallery and saw film of her masturbating and was utterly betrayed by that.
As you would be.
As you would be. And it's because not just of that, we should
it's
like
not,
her.
It's not just a private – see, as I was trying to say before, it's not just that she was filmed unbeknownst in an intensely intimate – private yes. moment, and then that was made public without her knowledge or consent.
It's that a friend did it, and a friend did it.
But that a friend did it, and that, as I said, it's that her friend overlooked her role as artist and her creativity and made her Edie Sedgwick and said, "This is all you are."
And put a dollar
this
amount
is all
to
you
it.
And put a dollar
said
around
you
to
could
it.
Buy this.
This is all you are. Yeah. This is all you yeah. are. You are a sensationalized, sexualized image with a dollar price
and
on
as
it.
A result of that, she's not likable.
You know, it's and because she's angry at this, she's not likable.
It's the Jennifer Weiner, because that's if this bit makes you angry, the Jennifer Weiner review
well,
is,
response,
a fucking
in
disgrace.
In response to that, that interview, there was, as we've said, there was a bit of a on the internet.
Although there is a good essay that you said was.
I think that's the technical term for it.
Yeah, what was it called?
On the
yeah.
internet. And in Slate, Jennifer Weiner wrote a piece which was titled, "I Like Likeable Characters." And she really did seem to miss the point of what Masood was saying. And the direction of her piece is really a. You know, it's the old positing quote-unquote literary fiction against commercial fiction, and this is a literary woman raging about, you know, the likable characters in commercial fiction and women shouldn't say bad things about
Jennifer
other...
is very much about the commercial fiction.
Yes.
She gets quite upset the New York Times Book Review doesn't review
exactly.
commercial fiction.
Which is
perfectly fair.
A genuine issue, but it's a different issue to what Claire Masood yes. was talking about. And her response to this interview, it's actually quite awful because she does miss the point and she talks about a different issue. But one of the things she says is, again, she picks up on the perceived anger in Claire Masood's response. In fact, she says, "Masood did everything but flip the table," as she answered. Yeah, I read her answer as frustrated as
but even
you know,
if she had flipped the table.
But that's a, you know, again, like this over emotion, right? Overreaction, too emotional, hysterical. This is a very gendered reading of text on a page with no stage cues or
that's not the word she says yeah. anyway.
But then she said okay, so I'm going to read you out this bit where she's talking about Masood and Meg Wolitzer, who's another author who has talked about slumber party fiction, right? It's sort of very comfortable. You like all the characters.
Is that actually a term?
Oh, that's it's a quote from Megan Wolitzer.
Okay.
Anyway, Masood and Wolitzer and the New Yorker's panel, which was a panel about likable female characters that the New Yorker magazine convened after this interview, which is very cool. I'll link to that as well. Imagine a dichotomous world, black or white, commercial or quality, literary or lovable. But it isn't always that simple. For one thing, the furious, vengeful, ranting lady isn't quite the invisible woman Masood imagines, not even in the realm of best-selling literary novels. Think of Ruth, the titular character of Faye Weldon's Lives and Loves of a She-Devil, or Eva Katchkadorian, the conflicted mother of the born bad, or was he, son in Lionel Shriver's We Need to Talk About Kevin. Or the loyal to a fault best friend Barbara in Zoe Heller's What Was She Thinking? Masood's Nora doesn't quite fit in with that sisterhood. Instead of asserting her rage and then showing readers its consequences through an action-packed, shock-filled plot or gradually revealing herself as something other than what she seems, Nora tells us she's angry. Then she shows us why she's angry, building up to her best friend's betrayal. Then she blah, 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 blah. There's no payoff, just a 300-page immersion in the acid bath of Nora's misery, her jealousy, her lack of compassion, her towering sense of entitlement.
No, every time you read that, it gets worse.
And further on, she says, absent her assertions about absent her reputation and previous reviews, this is referring to Claire Masood, the reader will be forgiven in wondering about the literary merits of a character who comes off like a curdled Bridget Jones, a singleton past her sell-by date, who is angry at her smug married friends for the sin of being more talented and successful than she is.
That is just like, it's like.
It's the
everything
most,
wrong you could say about this book.
It is the most hideously gendered response to that interview and to that book.
If I was the marketers of this book, where the woman upstairs, I'd actually have Jennifer Weiner, a Bridget Curdle Jones, and sell millions of copies. You know,
yeah.
But it is disgraceful.
Again, it is underscoring Masood's point that this is how we look at angry women. Women who voice their anger, women who aren't gentle and quiet and politic and domestic. This is how we view them. We view them as curdled singletons past their use-by date and women who have towering senses of entitlement because they're angry. And again, like her entire article just misses the point because she's pitting literary against commercial. She's saying women writers shouldn't diss other women writers because we should support other women. And that none of that is what Claire Masood was saying. So it's
I do wonder with the Lionel Shriver. We reviewed the Lionel Shriver book.
Which is another book that
Did it have the same sort of flack?
It did. There was a lot of talk about an unsympathetic narrator because I think we even talked about on the podcast
how cold and detached she is at times. And
How this makes a lot of people found her very unsympathetic, whereas I found her incredibly sympathetic, and I could see where her detachment had come from.
Yeah, and again,
why.
It means that this book, the Woman Upstairs, isn't the first time this has ever happened in literature.
No, of course not.
But it obviously hasn't happened enough for people to get over themselves.
Well, I think Woman Upstairs and We Need to Talk About Kevin, I think what both those books do really well is they present an uncommon representation of femaleness. And when I say uncommon, I don't mean in the world. I mean
in
art and popular culture, which is quite different because I think there are a lot of Eva Cacciadorians and Nora Eldridges in the world. But they present this and they give you the underpinnings. They give you the story. They make you see this isn't just an angry woman ranting about how a friend betrayed her. You know, they give you the story with We Need to Talk About Kevin. The story is laid out. And, I mean, you have the unreliable narrator thing because they're both first person, but both those first person characters concede the unreliability of the narration at many points throughout the books. And they say, this is how I saw it. It's possible that it was something else. It's possible that this is what he was thinking when he said that. I mean, the characters are very self-aware and quite fair in a sense to the people they're talking about. I mean, especially with Need to Talk About Kevin, Eva is, you know, she can't help see her son's actions and what he does in a certain way, but along the way she's constantly conceding that maybe she's too hard on him, that maybe, you know, and we can see why she's become this very cold, detached mother because it's out of self-defense. It's out of she almost has to be. And the reason why Nora is so angry, I mean, that betrayal is so layered and multi-leveled. It's and because it comes cold,
but obviously
it somehow makes it worse.
But obviously, because I think the point that Jennifer Weiner is saying is that, well, this is not new. This has been done before. But obviously, the trope hasn't been done enough.
No,
for it to have seeped into our subconscious, and we still get upset when either we read a book like this, or when the author of the book gets a bit upset by a stupid, well, not a stupid question, but a question that
a simplistic question.
Yes. Yes, and obviously
and
tilts the table in anger. You
and
know?
I think also, well, that's it. She all but flips the table. What? I'm sorry. I mean, to read her response as some over the top.
Kirsten, there are times on this podcast. There are times on this podcast when you get very angry. Very angry.
Flip tables.
And you, well, I do get worried. I do worry about the
worry about the table flipping.
Now there was a good. We've run out of time, but there is a good essay that you wanted to.
There's a really good essay by Susan Sheridan, which was in the Sydney Review of Books, and it's essentially a review of The Woman Upstairs, but it's quite long and in depth and looks into a lot of her literary and artistic references. Presents this book in the wider scope of her career as a writer. So I'm going to link to that. It's a very, very good overview of the book. But yeah, we don't have time to talk about it. No,
because we can't talk for 2 hours on one book.
That's right.
And as Abigail Abigail Nussbaum says, you can spoil a book like we've done here, but that doesn't mean you can't get something out of it if you read it. And I would recommend that if you've listened to the podcast without having read the book, I would still go and read The Woman Upstairs. A, because I think it's going to be a still talked about book as the year goes on, but B, because I think it's fucking brilliant.
It's a really good book. It's a book. I mean, I've got a digital version of it, but I'm going to buy the buy it in hardcover or hard copy because I love it. I really think it's going to be one of those very few books I have that I will go back and reread every few years.
I haven't really had a lot of quotes, but I absolutely highlighted the shit out of this book. There are that many great.
Yeah. Because again, it's another one of those books where it will really lend itself to a rereading. Yeah. Like having, like, knowing the end, knowing where it ends up, it will really lend itself to a rereading. Great. And the writing is just beautiful. And yeah, there are lots of pull quotes. I mean, Nora's wonderful. She's like, when she's angry, but she's not really bitter. She's more incensed. She's justifiably angry. She's, you know, she's not resentful. She's not bitter. She's not angry because Serena got to be this great artist and she didn't.
Yeah, it's none of that ego stuff. You know? It's got nothing to do with ego.
Because that's where I kind of thought it was going. I thought it might be going along that path. But that's the other reason why the betrayal cuts so deeply, because she is not ever, not once, resentful of Serena's success.
No,
she's genuinely happy for her. There's never any of these asides of, oh, well, she got to go to the New York Gallery and, you know, what's wrong with my work? She's genuinely happy for her friend.
I will say one thing, because we've got to end. But it's from the first person.
Yep.
She's writing this.
Yep.
It's her view.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We don't really hear Serena's view.
No, we don't at all.
So,
and she says that. She says that several times throughout the novel. She, you know, she's quite open about that, which is really good. It does allow you different views. But, I mean, short of accusing her of confabulation – If you take as you kind of must with a book like this, you must allow
you've got to have a sense of trust. Unless you must
allow the narrator something of an eidetic memory.
Yeah, and a sense of trust. And unless there's that whole unreliable thing.
Yeah,
that you
unless the author is playing with it, you must. The way you suspend your disbelief is to, yes, I believe you can remember that dialogue down pat. I don't believe you, because normally when someone is relating something that happened years ago, you go, do you really remember every word they said? Like, surely you're summarizing,
but
in a book like this, you have to accept that. So there are those things that you do, you take on faith. But if you're taking the events as they happened, and there's no indication in the book that they didn't, that Nora's making up. I mean, her interpretations of what happened are subjective, but there's no indication that she's made up the actual events that happened.
And as you read, Addis Massoud said, even if it is all fantastical, this is her experience and this is what she felt. Anyway, I think we're done.
So next week.
We're doing them weekly now. Great.
I say that every time.
I know you do. It's cute.
So next month.
It's not even that. It's next month.
Well, I was about to say.
Next month we're doing.
Next month I'm going to be in the UK.
Yes.
So there won't be a podcast, but we will be back in November at some time.
Yes.
And in November, I have recommended Nosferatu by Joe Hill, which is his latest novel.
And I have recommended the absolutely fucking amazing Sister Mine by...
Spoilers.
I know. By Nala Hopkinson. I think I did say on the last podcast I'd want to start recommending books that I genuinely really love. And Sister Mine's one of them. Before we go, I would like to do something naughty.
Okay. I'd like to
just do a bit of a shout out. There's a book coming out by a good friend of mine. I know we shouldn't be using the podcast for nefarious means.
I don't even use the podcast for my books.
Well, because you don't want to talk about it. But my mate Andrew McRae.
Oh, Truck Song.
Truck Song is coming out from 12th Planet Press in November. He actually sent me a description of the book. And I've read a bit of a draft of it.
Yep.
And I can tell you it'll be very good. But he's called it, it's Truck Song Petricide. It's Lost Love and AI Trucks. That is, yes, sentient trucks. In a post-apocalyptic Australian landscape, Mad Max meets True History of the Kelly Gang. And that's been published by 12th Planet Press in November. He's also put together a soundtrack for the book, which he's given us a link, which we can throw in the show notes if we want to, or not. I don't know. But I only do this because he's a very good friend and because he's an excellent writer, and you should support him and 12th Planet Press by buying the book in November.
Excellent. And we'll be back in November. In the meantime, you can leave us feedback by commenting on the website, which is writerandcritic.podbean.com, or you can send us an email, to writerandcritic@gmail.com, or you can tweet at us via the account we have there, which is writerandcritic.
Now, Fred.
Fred.
Fred tweets us a lot.
There we go. Thank you, Fred.
He's a major tweeter. He's a knucker in the tweeter factory. That's pretty Yiddish there for you. Okay, so, did we say 4 or 5 stars?
Oh, or you can leave us stars on iTunes.
Not that anyone does that anymore. I feel like that's redundant.
So, yes, you all have a lot more time to read the next two books, and we'll see you in November.
Yes, see you then. Bye. Are you losing the plot?
No, I'm finding the book.